Hi, my name is Dorothy Bass. This session is entitled Varieties of Religious Experience, Issues and Divisions in American Protestantism Today. It's a big topic, maybe even bigger than the self, finding it in an hour. Amidst the amazing diversity and richness of American religion, sometimes it's hard to find your way around. You know, and I hope that we can explore some ways this afternoon of finding our way around, of some ways of understanding the different groups that have emerged in American religious life. I think as we do, we may find ourselves challenged to embrace the village summer theme, embracing the contraries. Okay? Now, in a sense, I realize this is a kind of topic that might be dangerous. It's possible probably for me to offend almost everyone when I take on this kind of topic, because I'm going to try to characterize some different groups. I should say that I speak from the point of view of what I will be calling liberal Protestantism. I'm a minister in the United Church of Christ, which everyone would identify, I think, as a liberal denomination. Yet I'm married to a Lutheran, and we attend an ELCA congregation every Sunday. There's no UCC church in our town. And so I've gotten used to living in the midst of the diversity of American religion in a very real way, especially since I entered into this marriage, which my Missouri Synod relatives think of as an interfaith marriage. And I say this at the beginning, really, and I mean it to be humorous in that sense, because I really want to affirm that at the beginning, that I believe that what Christians of all sorts share with one another is much more important than the kinds of divisions and differences that I'll be laying out. Mark and I have certainly learned a great deal from each other on account of belonging to different sub-traditions within the larger Christian tradition. Okay. Now, one of the disadvantages of being in an interfaith marriage of this sort is that sometimes I find myself going to church just many times in a week, okay, because of the different kinds of commitments I would have to this denomination and that. And I want to start off this exploration by talking about a Sunday earlier this summer, this is true, when I went to church 3.5 times in one Sunday. Okay. The first service started at 9 o'clock. We live in a county seat town in northwest Indiana. There was a famous theologian coming to preach at the local First United Methodist Church. I'd never worshipped there before, but I wanted to hear this person, so I went. Now, this church is downtown, right by the courthouse, probably has 1,300 members. 500 or 600 were there at this early service. It was a very pleasant experience, very well organized, with the ushers taking you right to the seats and the guest sign up right in place, and I was called upon the next day to see if I'd like to join. The service took exactly 60 minutes. Okay, very good music. Everyone who read did a great job. Okay, it was a very pleasant and enriching and orderly experience. The announcements were read by the minister very quickly early in the service. Okay. Then at 10:45 we went to the relatively small Lutheran congregation where my family belongs. We have an average weekly attendance of 200 people. There were 80 or 100 at this late service. It was much warmer, and you could say a little bit fuzzier than the Methodist experience had been. You know, sometimes it goes 10 minutes longer than other times. Sometimes the announcements and concerns which the people themselves speak take up some of the time, okay? You get a sense of real family orientation and friendliness there, but with the Eucharist at the center. Okay. Then at 2:30 that afternoon, I went to worship with what we call Union Community Church, which is a new congregation in our town, founded by a black pastor who moved to town to work with a social agency and who decided that what the people in the town really needed was to be able to worship in a tradition which was comfortable for them, and started a church which worships in the African-American tradition, and the Black Church style, but which is an integrated congregation. And I've really been trying to help this group, and I feel committed to it. He happens to be a pastor in the United Church of Christ, so I've become part of this community also. Okay, there were at this service maybe 30 people, very spontaneous. Okay, the service began with testimony. How has the week been for you? How has God worked in your life this week? Joyful. Whenever prayer came, it could be open. The prayer could be open. People cried at various points. The singing was a cappella. Okay, very ragged in a certain sense, but very heartfelt in another sense. Very spontaneous, evangelical, and caring kind of situation. And those are three times. Then the halftime, after I got home from all this, and I'm not making this up, it's really all happened on one day, knock at the door, and there were two teenage girls there, and they introduced themselves as, they're from First Baptist Church in a neighboring town, and that they were canvassing the neighborhood to see if anyone didn't have a church home. And they wanted to know if I had given myself to Jesus Christ as my personal Lord and Savior. And I said that yes, I had, though I knew that there might be some differences in the way that they would interpret that. I asked them if it was Southern Baptist, and they said no, it was independent Baptist. And I said, it's fundamentalist, Bible-believing, premillennial. They said yes. Okay. And they were very nice, you know, and they, I thanked them, and that was that. You know, this is, in one day, a few hours, just a small sample of the kind of diversity that you can find in American Protestantism, right? I mean, there are many places, even in my own little town, that I could go that would be even more different from one another than these four examples, okay? But this is a good example, I think. We have a mainline liberal church, that the Methodist one I described, conservative evangelical group, the Baptists from the neighboring town, and I think two others that blend the two of those elements in a distinctive way. Lutheran church we were at, which has some evangelical elements and some mainline liberal elements, and the Black church tradition, which combines those two, I think, in another way. Now, as we try to make sense out of all this, you know, figure out who are the players, it's tempting to think, and many people would assume, that the best way to sort this out is by denomination. Okay, and you say, well, Methodism believes such and such, Lutheranism believes such and such, and you would go with theological correlations based on denominational origin. Okay. You run into some problems with this, right? There are all kinds of Methodist churches. Okay, some that are, you know, very liberated in a certain way, others that are very conservative. There are all kinds of Lutheran churches, there are all kinds of Black churches. Okay. And I want to invite you to try to think about these churches not denominationally, in your own church too. Okay. Not so much denominationally as by the possessing an ethos. Okay, the ethos that shapes and defines a certain expression of Christian life, which would include, yes, theology, and yes, denominational heritage in some ways, but would also include worship style, the family arrangements that are comfortable for the people that are involved, okay? The class feelings, okay? Different cultural ways of being, such that certain people be comfortable in one place and not another, and such that there's a certain life of its own to the kind of ethos that's embodied there. Okay, so it's not just theology, it's not just denomination, it's ethos and character.
Would you spell that,
please?
I can't quite understand what you're saying.
It's the... What does that mean in Greek?
Ethic.
Okay, ethic and pride.
Thank you.
Okay, now, scholars in my field are always trying to puzzle out a way to understand this range of diversity. And I'm going to propose a few categories and get you to discuss them with reference to your own perceptions, the churches you come from, and your own experiences, ways to make sense of what's been going on in American religion in the last 20 or 30 years. I'm going to propose three continuums, or continua, whatever, to look at these phenomena along. As I do this, let me remind you something that people, I mean, it's real important. The map is not the territory, okay? You can never draw a grid and put something as living and vital as a church or even an individual person on a certain map, you know, as if it were a scientific statement. You can't do that. But still, I think it's helpful to be able to orient ourselves to some of these continuums. Okay, the first one is a continuum of public faith and private faith, okay, or public religion and private religion. Martin Marty makes a good deal of this distinction in his work. Perhaps he's known to you. The clearest example of the public faith that among those examples that I just mentioned would be that of the First United Methodist Church that I described. Okay, the church, in a sense, vindicates its existence by the service that it renders to the whole world. Okay, you go in. There's a banner over the right up front. Go and serve. Okay. And people from this tradition, including myself, I mean, it's kind of gets in your blood. You know, if you're asked to do a benediction, you get up and send people out to serve. Okay? I mean, and the good of the whole world is, in a sense, the object and expression of the church. There is probably a strong sense of social concern in the public church. What is really offered, most of all, if you listen carefully, is an ethical message showing how the church and how Christians can do good in and for the whole of God's creation. You're liable to hear people talking a lot about the Good Samaritan or about the verses in Matthew when Jesus said, I was hungry and you gave me food, I was thirsty and you gave me drink. Okay, there's a favorite Bible verse for each one of these groups. You can hear it in what's prayed for. Okay. Now, sometimes such churches are politically liberal, and for instance, the Methodist Church I'm describing, the minister has been very active in the anti-nuclear movement for many years. He's one of the real visible liberals in our part of the world. But it could be conservative. Okay, the same kind of church could exist. It could be, for instance, a Southern Baptist church in a county seat town in Georgia, where all the bankers and merchants and others go and form a local establishment and support a certain mayor and you know, work against pornography in the community. It could be, being public doesn't necessarily mean being on a certain side of the issues. You can think of, for instance, the Episcopal Church built a national cathedral in Washington, D.C. Have any of you seen that? You know, a lot of state functions take place there. And it's, or semi-state functions, and it's there to represent a public concern. Now, on the other hand, the private faith, I think the clearest example was the one-to-one evangelism that I experienced with the teenagers from the Baptist church, in my example, okay, who wanted to talk to me in a very personal way about the state of my soul. It also comes out as a very prominent part of much of the Lutheran preaching that I hear, okay? In that the examples given in sermons and the kinds of things that children think about in Sunday school and so on very much have to do with family love, okay? With personal caring, okay? With it's a realm which I think the heritage of Lutheranism particularly has emphasized. Okay, the personal relationships, the private part of life, the family. And I have a strong appreciation for the way that the best of the black churches combine these two, you know, with a strong emphasis on personal spirituality and prayer that is almost evangelical in style, and asking about personal commitment and so on, with a real sense of the importance of that church within the life of the larger black community. And there are other, course, it's a continuum, not an either or. Most churches live somewhere along there. Now let me stop here before going on to the next one and see if we're clear about this, but also see if anybody has, if you understand, if this rings a bell, give me an example or a question or an objection. Public faith and private faith?
Experience or private faith would not necessarily have to be involved in a church then, would it? If we go to the far end of that continuum, it could be, I don't need it, I can go on a mountaintop kind of thing and commune, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And many people see this as an increasing trend in American religious life, the religious individualism. You know, that there's a strong spiritual quest afoot among the American people still, in spite of everything that all the secular critics were saying 20 years ago, religion will die out in modern society. This is not true. The people are on a spiritual quest. It often does go in very individual directions, even quite apart from belonging in a church, to a church, synagogue, or mosque. Do you know that, if I can get the statistic right, I don't remember exactly, more than 80% of the American people, including more than 80% of the churchgoers, report when asked in a poll that they think that one can be a good Christian or a good Jew without belonging to a church or synagogue. Okay, it's what's in your heart that matters. The church is not important. Okay, that's typical of American individualism. So the private, thank you, that's... when religion becomes a form of of psychotherapy in a sense, of care in just a very individual way, that's on the private end of this continuum, I think. Of course, many people participate in both ends at the same time in different parts of their lives, but it's a continuum. Yeah.
We're a Presbyterian, but I would say we have lots of very mature Christians in the sense that they've been Christians for a long time, even lots of retired pastors in our congregation, and they're much into the social issues.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
in Christian education, sometimes I would say if we have a brand new Christian that comes into our congregation, what will there be there to feed them at the level where they are?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
even we might have a child that would grow up in our church and then go someplace else and say, gee, you know, I became a born-again Christian.
Uh-huh.
I never heard that at our church, even though I grew up in Sunday school there. So
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I can see your continuum.
Yeah, well, thanks. And that's, right, that's a good example of how hard it is to hold them in tension.
Right.
I mean, I've been real concerned through, I started ministry 20 years ago, and I've known a lot of people who get so into public issues that they lose a sense of personal spirituality and they burn out in a certain way. I've known other people who become so intrigued with the growth of their individual soul that they forget about the world. You know, so how do you hold it in tension? And some churches go one way more than the other.
Our National General Assembly moderator said recently, because we've been, as Presbyterians, so criticized for being social issue as
right.
opposed to evangelical.
Uh-huh.
He says that what Jesus means to each one of us is the biggest kept secret in the Presbyterian church.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A missionary told us that from the pulpit one Sunday this summer.
Uh-huh.
Stuck in my head.
Yeah, and that's I think that's true. Right. I grew up Presbyterian, so. Mm-hmm.
What's very fascinating is that even within a particular congregation, there's this diversity. You don't even have to.
That's a good point.
We've got people. I've been a Lutheran all my life. We've got people in our congregation, a lot of Unitarians, who come to Lutheran churches because their parents did. Would probably be happier
mm-hmm.
being Unitarians and have more collegiality.
Mm-hmm.
And other
mm-hmm.
people that would be better off as Baptists.
Mm-hmm.
And become mm-hmm. because of tradition, mm-hmm. and it must be different for the minister. They hear different things in the sermon,
mm-hmm.
they hear different things in the prayers, they get
mm-hmm.
angry about different issues,
mm-hmm.
and it's tricky.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think this is why we hear, even here at Holden, we're united by our common faith and by the Eucharist, not by each individual precept, right? But that's helpful. You're right. This kind of diversity and division exists at every level. Mm-hmm. But yes.
Yeah, I was interested in your comment about having attended this United Methodist Church, I belong to United Methodist Church in Seattle. It's also, well, I wouldn't say a lot of us anymore, but it's physically perhaps, but not in terms of membership or attendance. Anyhow, I remember the pastor that we did have up until a little over a year ago made a comment once that it was, well, the church membership ran all the way and the entire gamut from being, I think as he put it, as the, well, what do you call it, the very ultra conservative to the other extreme.
Yes.
And so he was sometimes at a loss, I think, on how to handle that situation, but I should add, he had a certain attitude towards Christianity, towards Jesus and so on, that resulted in quite a lot of the membership taking off to other churches.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, these are all helpful comments. I think we're on to the nature of this continuum. Let's go on to the next continuum.
I should add that I look upon the substantial portion of the membership as being, quote, old fogies.
Great.
I have to classify myself as being in the older generation. I have been threatening from time to time to quit that church and seek out another church because it's just too conservative. I can't stand it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good luck. Okay. Now the second continuum I want to propose, I've taken from some sociologists, but it's the continuum from institutional to emergent. Okay, let's think about this. Most religious movements emerge out of very vibrant new beginnings. Okay, some new insight, some new experience, or a renewed, perhaps, some recovery of something from the past that is tremendously energizing and exciting to that first generation of people who hold it. Okay, and then most of them end up maturing into fairly stodgy institutions, which get set in their ways. Right? This is true of almost every religious movement I can think of. Now, the Methodist Church that I described, I would put the institutional end of this spectrum in the sense that if you were pastor of that church, you would know for the good of your institution, it's going to be over it 1 hour, okay? 1 hour. No fooling around, right? And there's not going to be that much room for spontaneity that might disrupt that. That day that I went to all these churches, the roof was leaking in the black church. People made jokes and said, praise God, it's not on our heads, it's just on the floor. Okay? If this had happened in the First United Methodist Church, it would have been a real problem. Okay?
Get a committee to fix it.
Yeah, get a committee together, right. Or if someone had stood up and testified, really either in the Lutheran Church or the Methodist Church that I described, you know, this would be kind of a problem. We want to, you know, there's a certain order and a certain organization. But taking the Methodist Church, how did that begin? It begins with John Wesley, a bunch of other college students, okay, out deciding that the established church in their time is missing a certain evangelical element. So they get on horses, they ride around, they speak to people in open fields. They organize small groups of very devoted people. I mean, so it had an emergent, exciting beginning. Okay, which is still present as one strain, I think. Lutherans are a great example of emergent and institutional religion. I mean, the young Luther is just one of the most emergent guys you can think of. You know, standing in opposition to the Church of Rome, burning a papal bull written against him, standing up in front of the assembly of the rulers and saying, here I stand, I can do no other, and, you know, deserted we will follow the crucified Christ. I mean, being willing to undergo martyrdom if necessary to fulfill the wonderful new insight about justification by grace through faith, which he had worked his way through or had been given to him as a gift. I mean, this was a tremendously exciting and emergent religious movement. 10 years later, he's persecuting the peasants, right? there is still always that freshness of insight available within the Lutheran tradition. But there's also then a codification and an institutional quality that takes place as any tradition seeks to extend itself through time, right, and to get itself organized. The Union Community Church, the primarily black congregation I spoke about, there's a vivid sense of the freshness and newness of this. There are people there who have been living in the community for 20 years and have had no place of worship that was really familiar and comfortable for them, and their joy at being in this setting was just palpable, and the tears were flowing, and it was just a very emergent sense. But how are we going to pay that minister? Well, let's become a new church development of the United Church of Christ. Okay, get him on the pension plan, get him on the health insurance plan, which I really believe he needs. Okay, get some funding for the first 5 years while we build. Send him to meetings. Send me and other people to meetings. Start getting bureaucratized and into the yearbook and all that. Right? And there's some resistance. But we'll probably do it. Okay? So there's that tension again. What about the conservative evangelical teenagers who came? Door knocking of that sort could be a ritualized activity, you know, forced upon them as part of the youth group. Or it could be a really spontaneous and genuine expression. And many people think I would agree, that the vitality of some evangelical conservative youth movements on college campuses in the last 20 years have been emergent in this sense. I mean, that young people have communicated their excitement about being Christian to their friends and have created new communities which are vital to them. But you can also be liberal and emergent. I mean, when I was in seminary in 1969 in New York City, we would go down to Grand Central Station in the morning and hand out anti-war pamphlets. Right, Vietnam was on, and then we would sing a few rounds of "If I Had a Hammer" and "Amazing Grace" and things like that. I mean, you know, we felt tremendously energized, as if we were part of a revitalization of Christian witness in our time. Okay, so there's the kind of some examples of this institutional and emergent continuum. Other examples, explications, objections. Anybody? Can you think of such examples in your own life or that you observe round about?
Isn't that true not just with religious movements, but almost any movement? You know, if you go back to the Vietnam days, mm-hmm. and you talk about Jerry Rubin and all those, the yippies, you know, mm-hmm. and they follow those folks through over 20 years, and they mm-hmm. talk about the transitions that they made and how many of them became involved in kind of a whole bureaucracy and the institutional stuff. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be natural that not just in religious movements, but in any kind of sociological movement, mm-hmm. you go from an emergence to an institution. I mean, I don't know if there's any that haven't been the case.
Yeah, that probably is true. That's probably very helpful.
Yeah. Sometimes you see the shift backwards as well. I think the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. it's gone through in the past 20 years, it's gone from very institutional to some less institutional setting and mm-hmm. much more movement towards the Protestant churches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or would you also say that, I mean, there's a certain aspect of contemporary Catholicism that still is very institutional, but there are all these emergent movements within it. You know, whether it's women sharing communion among themselves or, you know, professors who are preaching over against the Vatican, risking all kinds of things, or lay movements or base communities.
Or very evangelical movements.
Charismatic, charismatic Catholics, right.
Would you call it emergent when the group that wants to go back to the Latin Mass?
Well, I think it probably is, yeah. Because they feel, because often in Protestant Christianity especially, but Catholic too, there's effort to recapture the New Testament situation, for instance. You know, to go back is part of what it means to become true and to go forward faithfully. Right? To restore the original is part of what it means to become faithful now. So I bet there's a lot of the feeling. I haven't moved in that circle, but I imagine there's a lot of the feeling of righteousness over against a corrupt institution there. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it's part of the emergence, but I'm a part of a congregation that's over 100 years old. Mm-hmm. And I think within a congregation that you can experience some of this newness. When we first got the LBW in our congregation and learned all these new liturgies, mm-hmm. and learned to pass the peace and learned to think of the Eucharist as what it was meant to be, mm-hmm. and use it more often, all those things really became quite exciting to a congregation that had been pretty dull,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a renewal experience, mm-hmm. for the congregation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's good. I think it is a continuous, it's a tension. Individuals within the stodgiest of congregations might themselves have just discovered what grace is in their lives, right? And be in a time of great excitement, emergence. So. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a bit ago about something having, well, this pastor, I guess it was, bringing up to you the matter of whether you've been saved or not. I mean, you mm-hmm. saved in quotes around mm-hmm. it. Yeah. Well, in the beginning of this book, there's a foreword by a psychiatrist by the name of, I think his name is James A. Knight. And he has indicated that the business about being, quote, saved, unquote, is, he didn't say, he didn't put it these kind of words, but in effect, it's a bunch of malarkey. That the Bible didn't say being saved, or Christ didn't say being saved, but rather be healed. And the prime function of the church, of the Christian church, is that of a healing function mm-hmm. of the church, mm-hmm. not to be saved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting perspective, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now let me go on to this third continuum, liberal and conservative. Okay. Now, to me, the best way to understand this one, these are such loaded words, and even, you know, the Democratic and Republican Party can't get straight about how they want to claim these words, and I'm sorry that they're loaded, but if I give them some historical content, maybe you'll agree to talk about them for a little while. Okay. I think the best way for me to understand this particular continuum is to go back almost 100 years in history to the point where certain aspects of what modern society and thought were going to be started to become evident to Christians and to really challenge their faith. Okay? For example, the idea of biological natural evolution. Okay? For example, the idea that the Bible has a history, you know, was not just dictated into Moses' ear, but has a history, and that there, you know, Isaiah had several different authors, and this kind of thing. These are, you know, these were new and unsettling ideas. For example, the idea of social science, that people behave in certain ways, not just for religious reasons, but that the churches and ourselves are very much immersed in our own cultures and in our societies. Just the experience of living in large and diverse cities, okay, with new kinds of justice problems becoming evident. Okay, the idea that more and more people were living outside of their own, could not just be in a religious ghetto where they only knew one kind of Christian, but they were meeting different kinds of Christians. Okay, and they were encountering different kinds of problems. And this, the kinds of challenges that this poses have hit different groups at different times. But some churches started to deal with these about 100 years ago. And over that period of time, two parties, or two basic ways of approaching these questions, I think, have emerged. And one is the one I would call liberal, okay? And which found theological ways to see the scientific ideas and other challenges to traditional Christian ways of explaining things to be compatible with Christian faith, okay, to revise the theology so that it's compatible, for instance, to believe in evolution and to be a Christian. And this includes coming up with new forms of biblical interpretation. Okay, and this group would also basically affirm what they would see as progress in human society, as science proceeded, as mass society emerged. They basically thought that some of the things that were happening were positive and progress and towards God's intention for humanity. And also gradually they came to accept diversity, even theologically, not to think that their way was the only way to be close to God, okay, or even to be redeemed. So that even in the early 20th century, a few of them, for instance, would open a settlement house in a city and would not seek to convert the people who came. You know, this even became true in foreign missions after the 1920s. Okay, so that's the group I would call liberal. Certain kind of accommodation to features of modern life and thought. Okay, now another party emerges over a long period of time that is militantly opposed to this accommodation of Christianity to these new forms. Okay, that opposes the accommodation of Christianity to evolution, historical criticism of the Bible, pluralism, and so on. And this group comes up with a view of biblical inerrancy, okay, which will not admit new scientific findings, far from thinking that that Western society is progressing. This group is very disturbed by what it sees in Western society and thinks that, in fact, the end time must be near. And pluralism, or the acceptance of many different ways to God, is rejected, okay, with a reaffirmation that there is one way. And I would call this group conservative. And there are many, many, many shadings, many varieties within. But this would be the way in which I would depict that. Now, since the 1920s, I think it's been evident that these two parties were present. And since the 1920s, the conservative groups have been growing much more quickly than the liberal groups. Okay? But from about 1920 to about 1965, the liberal groups, and here, let's name a few: Presbyterian Church, Episcopal, United Church of Christ, Disciples of Christ, Northern Baptists, Methodist, okay, and probably LCA, and some parts of the ALC. Okay. They were growing as the population grew. From 1920 to 1965. Starting in 1965, they start to go down. So that the Presbyterians, for instance, have lost 25 to 30% of their members. They're 25 to 30% smaller than they were in 1965 now. Okay. The United Church of Christ, about 15%, Episcopal Church, about 20%. Methodist Church has lost 3 or 4 million members out of 13 million. Okay, so I mean, there are major losses. While the conservative groups have been growing much faster than the population. Now let's stop here and explicate and give examples of this. Any, as we did before, any comments on this division or questions about that? Or Amos?
Yeah, I was wondering how you explain why this is happening, why these mainline, supposedly mainline churches, who have gotten to be more liberal, you might say, are losing ground. I mean, this is a question I think we really need to face.
Okay. Well, I'll say some of the things that researchers are finding and that I think are important. The real cultural dividing line is the 60s. And I think that when historians look back on American history, the 60s really will stand as a major shift in the configuration of American life in lots of ways. And by the 60s, it's clear that in liberal, even secular culture generally, there's a whole set of values which are particularly now associated with the baby boom generation, and which have to do with individualism, okay, the self-expression, not believing without belonging, Okay, the idea that you can be religious without necessarily being accountable to a community of faith. And that basically, research shows very clearly that the people who have left the liberal churches have not themselves, if you follow those persons, they have not stood up across the street to a fundamentalist church and sat down. They have not. They're out to brunch. Okay? They're on their boats. They're skiing. They're doing the laundry because they are two career families. Okay? But they're not basically, those people are not getting up and moving across the street to the fundamentalist church. More people switch the other way, though it's not a big margin. I mean, it's not a major set. The other thing is that a long time ago, well, even 20, 30, 40 years ago, people would sometimes move to more sophisticated churches as their career. For instance, if you were, you know, born to a Baptist farmer, and then you end up going to college and became a banker, then you join the Presbyterian Church, right? And this has stopped. It's now perfectly acceptable to be a Baptist and a banker, okay? So that kind of switching has stopped. And also the birth rates are much higher in the more conservative churches than they are in the liberal churches, okay? They're higher in the conservative churches than they are the birth rates. Yes, I mean that Jehovah's Witnesses women have a lot more children than United Church of Christ women. Okay, that's. But then there's also, given these views about the purpose of the church is to serve and to be just ethical, you know, or the familiarity with modern thought, okay? The boundaries are very, I don't think that a lot of the liberal churches have really emphasized how important it is to be part of the church, okay? And since they've given up saying that this was the one way to be saved, that basically the reason that they have lost members is that their own young people don't come back. And that's, if you look at what's happened, that's the basic reason. Their own young people, when it comes time for them to join, do not do so. And they haven't got the message that it's essential for them to do so in any particular way in their lives, because there's almost a reluctance to make a strong case for Christianity in some liberal churches. I mean, so this is how I would assess it.
Is the average age of the liberal church, of the liberal church, rising then?
Yes. Yes, and so this becomes a cycle. Okay, it becomes a cycle. So if your young people aren't coming back, then the average age rises, and it's up in the high 50s in most of the denominations I've named. Whereas in, say, Seventh-day Adventists, it's below 30. Okay, so, and those people are not going to have more children. So, I think another part of it, I don't know how many of you are, I see Methodist, Presbyterian, that's interesting. How many of you are not Lutheran? But I think the Lutheran Church that the ELCA is going to be facing some of these same issues. You know, as partly because I think one of the things which has kept churches together has been ethnicity. And in fact, some of these struggles that were taking place about modern thought and so on, and that were just tearing American Presbyterianism up in 1920, were not as pressing on certain ones of the Lutheran synods because they were still immigrant communities who were attending to other kinds of questions. How do we become American? Do we want to become American? How do we be faithful to our traditions culturally and so on? So there are different kinds of questions, but those questions and the ethnic ties which would reinforce marriage patterns through the generations to keep the community intact are going to be changing. And they're already clearly changing. And so some of these questions will be facing Lutheran churches too, I think. And you can see American Lutheranism dividing into these parties, I think, along a continuum again, but with Missouri and Wisconsin getting even more associated with conservative positions and with the ELCA looking more and more like a mainline church. Now, my own view, a couple of things that seem to me important as a Christian in dealing with all this. One reason I think that that some of the churches didn't grow or have lost their appeal is that they simply got lazy. I mean, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, people like this, I mean, they thought they owned the place, you know, the country. They were just kind of natural Americans, and they would always be number one. And the society has changed, okay? They are truly disestablished now. This is truly a diverse society. No one group can claim to be on top and shouldn't want to be within this kind of diverse system. Okay? I think that within, I could imagine certain parts of the Midwest and West, that Lutherans might face the same temptation. You know, that we, you know, we have a community which is kind of very secure and privileged, and we don't need to offer ourselves to the public, right? Invite people, tell them the treasures that we have. You know? So that's one perspective. I think that all the churches need to learn to think of themselves as disestablished, as on the margins of the society, ready then to let the society know what we can offer. Okay, that's one point. Another one is, though, that I think that the churches which do come to terms with certain features of modern science, with the fact of diversity in American and global society, okay, with justice issues, okay, with the historical criticism of the Bible, that there is a need, and there is some real truth in that position which needs to be offered to people and which would have an appeal if we could show the excitement about it. Okay, seems to me that in every generation, Christians have had to reformulate, rethink, represent their faith. And that's what the liberal tradition, in a sense, says we can do explicitly. Okay, let's see, what does it mean to be a Christian in 1989? Okay, and think about that and make a case for it. You know, because it really is something that people need and that is, you know, true and important to offer. Yeah, Rob.
There's a lot of things that are going around. A couple of observations. When you drew the contrast between liberal and conservative, you drew it along epistemological lines, essentially. Ways of knowing. So a scientific way of knowing or a historical way of knowing, which led to historical critical or literary critical approaches to the Bible, mm-hmm. which caused the split. Mm-hmm. And then the scientific ways of knowing, which caused the split between modernism and fundamentalism or between liberalism and conservatism. But it's also striking, at least to me when I look back at the 19th century, that the great social transformative movements of the 19th century, such as women's suffrage, such as abolition, were sponsored by the conservatives, not by the liberals. So that it was largely the Quaker and the Wesleyan women who, for very distinctive religious reasons, I think, largely, led a woman's suffrage in its primitive stage, and abolition, the Underground Railroad, the Wesleyan Connection in upstate New York, created the Underground Railroad. So what one finds, or at least one could argue, that whereas I think the liberal-conservative distinction can be made on the basis of ways of knowing, scientific, historical ways of knowing, that when one talks about justice issues and that it is essentially the liberal or the mainstream church that sponsors justice issues, I think that's a little bit more difficult to make, especially if you include in the conservative tradition the Pentecostal communions, mm-hmm. which have long, I mean, my own tradition, Free Methodism, ordained women in the 19th century for as elders for the work of ministry as a Pentecostals.
But see, I mean, a lot that you're saying is true. That's why I don't want to start even talk about this division until 100 years ago. I mean, I really think that you can't sort out who's who. That you look back at that whole 19th century evangelical movement, and I see that as the forerunner of the United Church of Christ. You see it as the forerunner, apparently, of a different group. You know, I mean, there's a... I think that 19th century evangelicalism included all the groups that now are either liberal or conservative
But surely that can't be. I mean, if one looks at the National Association of Evangelicals, for instance, the communions of believers that make up the National Association of Evangelicals are primarily those that made up the Wesleyan groups of the 19th century that were at the forefront, and the Quakers, the French.
The Quakers are quite liberal.
Quakers are
well, yeah, well, no, the conser- there's a conservative.
But I think, well, I don't think it makes.
This is a large area for conservatives.
Yeah, I think that it would be a mistake for us to use the few remaining minutes to go into what requires a lot more information. Almost everybody in this room has, okay.
Yeah.
But we can talk about it afterwards. But I won't concede the 19th century movements to that.
No. Could I make
I,
one
I
other?
I just don't think the division existed at that point.
Well, let me make, if I could, another comment. I'm wondering if part of it, too, the emergent conservative ends of things. James Barr.
I don't mean those to be correlated in any
no,
way.
No, I'm thinking of a correlation. I don't mean that you are. I'm just thinking of a correlation in my own mind. James Barr argues that within the synagogue and perhaps also within the church, most renewal movements have been reactionary. That is, they have been an effort to recover something that has been lost from the tradition. And so the great renewal movements, the emergence of new spiritual and religious vitality, are oftentimes sponsored by conservatives, that is, by persons who want to conserve something from the past that is lacking. And I'm wondering if, in fact, there is some way of correlating the two. Charismatic renewal in the institutional mainstream mm-hmm. church, I think, is a classic case of an energizing that has really been a conservative movement within a liberal mainstream church.
No, I think that's true. I mean, these terms are very difficult to use. That's why I think it is best to understand them basically in different ways of relating to modern thought. And I think that's the clearest way that kind of consistently moves you through. I wanted to ask just one thing. I think we're almost out of time. Where would you place Holden Village in all of this?
Which one are we going to use?
All of them. This is multidimensional.
Well, I guess what I've observed about Holden's inquiry is that, in a sense, it's sort of at the cutting edge of dealing with things that maybe the ordinary church doesn't deal with so often, perhaps. I mean, Holden is more of a mind-expanding place. Yes, it's a spiritual movement too, but it's to stretch your mind perception about theology. And obviously, not everyone of us is going to agree with everything that goes on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, we come from I came from the ALC.
You look like you wanted to say. Did you? No.
I guess I would like to see that Holden Village is a place that has everyone in the continuum gathering here, and I think it does. And then it's a challenge to all of us on that continuum to try to figure things out in our faith.
Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Having been here four times, I don't think there's any doubt in my mind that at least in the eyes of the ELCA, right now, Holden Village would be probably converted to liberal.
And what about your?
I don't think there's any other place like this in the Lutheran Church where people can come and have these kind of discussions actually right now.
Mm-hmm.
The only one there I disagree with is that I think Holden is trying at least to be on both ends and not in the middle of that public fragment.
Yeah, I heard that too.
To a liberal, according to Lutheranism, I think liberal, would, you know, Unitarian would not consider this a liberal.
Right. No, I think that especially holding together that public and private is something that almost all Christians historically have wanted to do. But if you look at them, you can see them veering off. I even, for liberal and conservative, if I can make one last comment from my own perspective in the liberal church, you know, I think that the liberal churches have veered much too far from, not veered, I think that there's a task of appreciation of the wisdom of the past and the real riches of the tradition, which can be forgotten, okay, in the midst of being relevant and up to date. And I think that part of the revitalization of the mainline churches and part of the continuing vitality of the ELCA, it's going to have to be having a voice which is authentically Christian and not just one which is accommodating to the forces of the modern world. It's very tough to sustain a Christian identity, and it takes a lot of nurturing and a lot of study of the past, and I think that that continuum is one that can be bridged in some ways too. In fact, perhaps all the contraries would be embraced in the best possible expression.
What happened to the Polish church now that it's more accepted? I'm feeling that a lot
be
of the strength of the Polish church has come in being against communism.
Mm-hmm.
And now that they've become part of the government, it seems to me that there's going to lack a lot of vitality. We'll sap a lot of vitality out of the church itself.
Mm-hmm. That will be interesting to see. Yeah. Thanks.
Do we have another session?